What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. You have to be a special kind of famous for a semi-obscure satirical punk rock band to make a song about you. The Dead Milkmen, a Philadelphia phenom since their first record in 1985, released the catchy Marianne Cotton, The Poisoner's Song in 2012. Sung by Joe Jack Talcum, the song was included on the band's 2014 album, Pretty Music for Pretty People. And if you're not familiar with the Milkmen, you should know that they're the kind of band that once wrote a song called Punk Rock Girl that became an MTV hit in 1988, and another called Bitchin' Camaro that's exactly what you think it is. They've been skewering American culture since the Reagan era, taking aim at everything from pretentious hipsters to intellectual posturing to the absurdities of modern life. I said they were satirical. That was their choice. They were of the opinion that punk rock had gotten too serious. So when they decided to write about a Victorian-era serial killer, you know they weren't going to make it your typical true crime ballad. I'll give you a snippet of the lyrics so you can see what I mean. Marianne Cotton was hanged from the gallows, and on her grave a strychnine plant grows. In Mary's footsteps, others will follow, for there's no end to what the public will swallow. Yikes, that's dark. And funny, but mostly dark. The song's refrain is equally depressing. The lyrics are, "Poison makes the world go round, poison makes the world spin." In an interview with Austin Kaus of 605 Magazine, band member Talcum, his real name is Joseph Gennaro, was asked about the woman behind the song. "Yeah," he said, "she was something else before serial killing became popular." He's not wrong. We're talking about crimes that happened a century before anyone would even use the term serial killer in print. The phrase wouldn't appear in English until the 1960s and wouldn't become common until the 1980s. But make no mistake, that's exactly what she was. Talcum / Gennaro added that he's fascinated by the duplicitous nature of chemicals and technology, that they can be thought of as good for us until we find out that they aren't. "Chemicals are cool," he opined. "It's like playing with fire. You don't know what's going to happen." Marianne Cotton knew what was going to happen when she surreptitiously fed arsenic to as many as 21 people, a number which included many of her own children, three of her four husbands, and her mother. She played with fire as well because even in Victorian England in the mid-1800s, early forensic chemists were already unraveling ways to detect the poison's presence in the human body. That is, they were sciencing a way to stop her. But not before she would become, and still remains, the most prolific female serial killer in Britain's history.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Marianne Cotton was born on Halloween in 1832 in the village of Low Moresley in County Durham, a coal-rich area of northeastern England that borders on the North Sea. 2 years later, her parents, Michael and Margaret Robson, had a second daughter named after her mother. Sadly, baby Margaret would die within a month. A son named Robert was born a year later. Another called Michael followed soon after that. Like most in their small town, the Robsons toiled in harsh conditions to keep food on the table. But poverty is what they knew, and despite 12-hour workdays and 6-day work weeks, her father could not escape the arduous existence of life deep in the coal mines. His one day off was spent in church with his family on Sundays. It was a life of subsistence and not much else. This, despite the fact that the empire that England's Queen Victoria inherited in 1837 and reigned over until 1901 saw a flourishing of literature and art, burgeoning industrial might, and a wealth of scientific advancement. Of course, not everyone shared in its spoils. The working class that made the industrial wheels turn lived in crowded and often unsanitary housing. In order to make ends meet, they were often forced to put their children to work alongside them in dangerous factories. The result was an alarming rate of injury, disease, and death. They had little power to change any of it. The Robsons were those people. Here's Tom Norris of the UK's I Could Murder a podcast talking about Marianne's childhood.
The family were strict Methodists, and they raised their family to be God-fearing, believing that any hardships coming their way had come directly from their God. Both parents were allegedly physically abusive of their children for the slightest possible infraction.
Marianne seemed like a typical child of the era to those who knew her. Her father was a colliery sinker, a man who dug pit shafts. That was a small distinction above other mining jobs and meant he made enough money that she was not put to work to help the family eat. Every miner was housed in company-provided accommodations. Marianne attended Wesleyan Sunday School, where a superintendent's remarks about her were later uncovered. He found her to be
a most exemplary and regular attender. She is a girl of innocent disposition and average intelligence. She is distinguished for her particularly clean and tidy appearance and long, flowing black hair. She comes from a dedicated family who are devout members of their church's congregation.
Life was good, or good enough. That is, until Marianne was 9. One day in 1842, her father was working on a new mine in the village of Merton, where they had just moved. He was positioned on a platform above an open 150-foot mine shaft. The platform somehow gave way, and he fell to his death. He was 30 years old. Here's actress Joanne Froggatt, who studied Marianne's story to portray her in a PBS drama called Dark Angel.
I think that was a very traumatic experience for her because he was brought back from the pit in a wheelbarrow in a sack labelled property of South Hatton Coal Company, which was the company he worked for. So I think that was definitely a huge part of some sort of change in her.
A small aside to give you an idea of how dangerous it was to work in the mines. Michael Robson was apparently the first of some 400 men to perish while working on this particular mine. It was an active mine from 1842 until 1991. Back in 1842, such deaths were common, even expected. That Robson's shattered body was placed in a company-branded sack a short time after he'd breathed his last and delivered to his family in a wheelbarrow, well, that was pretty common too. Before the funeral could even be planned, the company told the family to vacate their company-provided home. Some experts like to point to this moment in Marianne's life as the one that broke her. They say her heart was hardened and her instinct for survival sharpened such that she immediately vowed, literally or figuratively, that she would never allow herself to live in fear of imminent destitution. I mean, it didn't take a genius to understand that money would have fixed a great deal of what was wrong in the life her family was leading. Others think that her father's death made Marianne want to lessen suffering before it got worse. It's the so-called dark angel motivation for killing. She would learn to kill to be kind. Still others think that Marianne was born a psychopath. For what it's worth, Froggatt thinks it was a little from column A, a little from column B.
Whether she started out that way or whether it was a product of her environment, that's sort of the question. Or whether it was a mixture of the two. I mean, in my mind, it was probably a mixture of the two.
In any case, she was still just 9, freshly uprooted and scared. With little other choice, her mother hastened to remarry. She married George Stott within the year. He was also a minor, and Margaret Robson knew what she was bargaining for. But she needed housing. She needed to feed her children. And maybe she needed to learn to look the other way. That's because some research indicates that Stott sexually abused Marianne on several occasions, beginning when she was just 11. By the time she was 12, the girl of average intelligence was already thinking of how to get out of her stepfather's house. She couldn't just leave, of course, because she'd be put in a workhouse if found on the streets. The workhouse was a fate worse than death. At least her stepfather made enough of a salary that no one was forcing her to work in the factories for long hours, little pay, little safety, little decent food, and an early death. When she was 16, a manager at the Merton Colliery made it known around town that he needed a nanny and nursemaid to his 12 children after his wife died. Marianne took the job. There's little to suggest that Edward Potter treated Marianne with anything but an employer's expectation that she keep his children cared for, fed, and quiet when he was at home. Again, some who want to explain Marianne's apparent dislike for children have suggested that perhaps she was badly treated in the Potter home, or that the children were an impossible burden for a young woman who had little experience to help her manage. They want to show that she only saw children as in the way, or worse, as needy, dirty, clingy things to be dealt with until you could pawn them off on others. I mean, I can't be sure about this analysis of her motives a century and a half after her death. It's likely she wasn't treated great because girls and women of her station rarely were. I can say that as an adult, she seems to have experienced no inherent need to bond with children, nor have empathy with them when they suffered. Whether she was born that way or evolved into it is a question for the ages. After 3 years in the Potter home, where she had grown used to better food and better accommodations than she had growing up, Marianne's services were no longer necessary as the children were sent off to boarding school. She was forced to return to her mother's house to see what was next. She understood all too well how limited her options were as a woman in the mid-19th century. She would work within the limits. By now, she was almost 20 and, by all accounts, quite beautiful. She trained as a dressmaker, imagining herself with a posh shop somewhere, beholden to no one. But there was not much call for finery in coal country. So, in 1852, she married William Mowbray, who worked as a laborer and, at times, a colliery foreman. Now, you should know that from this point forward, Marianne will get pregnant with mind-boggling frequency. That would not prove to be a blessing. Her first years with Mowbray are marked by several miscarriages in rapid succession. She may have lost 4 or 5 babies before they came to term. This, again, prompts some experts to assume this accounts for her ever-increasing lack of emotional response to children of any kind. It may also point to a warping grief. Hard to know, but she and William soon moved to Plymouth, a port city where dock workers serviced the large British fleet. They continued to try and make a family. They moved again in 1856 to the shipbuilding hub of Hendon. By 1864, only 2 children were living, though Marianne may have been pregnant as many as 9 times. It's a hard number to pin down, as miscarriages were not usually recorded in registry offices, nor was there any legal requirement at this time to register births or deaths. Graham Yorston, a forensic psychiatrist, looked at Marianne's case in an episode of Insane History. He tries to explain some of the gaps in this period of her life.
What is clear, though, is that most of her children did not survive infancy. Those deaths that were recorded were put down to gastric fever, a commonly used but non-specific term for the gastrointestinal ailments that were all too common in Victorian England, where poor sanitation and contaminated water contributed to the fearful statistic that 1 in 3 children did not make it to their 5th birthday.
1 in 3 is a pretty shocking statistic. So maybe Marianne is blameless here. In fact, those early deaths, known to those who lived among the Mowbrays, did not draw any suspicion. To be fair, a lot of babies died not just because of bad water, but because of all that innovation I spoke about earlier. New to the Victorians were baby bottles that, because of their design, were hard to clean. The instructions they came with didn't help, offering mothers the advice to wash them every 2 or 3 weeks in warm water. Yikes. As host Kelly Beard explains in an episode of A Popular History of Unpopular Things, mothers unwittingly fed their children, well, germs.
Some kids develop some pretty rough diseases like dysentery and typhoid. Dysentery is a bacterial or parasitical infection that causes bloody diarrhea and the usual symptoms of an infection: fever, pain, nausea, vomiting, but also dehydration, which in small children is really, really dangerous. Typhoid is a bacterial infection and can impact your digestive system or your bloodstream.
So let's review. Marianne has had babies die of gastric fever. 2 have lived: Margaret Jane, born in 1856, and Isabella, born in 1858. It is little wonder that Marianne pushed William to secure some low-cost life insurance for the children and himself. Like a good provider, he agreed. By this time, the Mowbrays had moved north again for better work. William got a job on a steam vessel that required him to leave his family alone for much of the time. In 1860, little Margaret Jane died while William was away, to be replaced after his temporary return with another daughter, also named Margaret Jane, born in 1861. Sorry if this naming ritual is confusing. I had to keep a chart. A son, John Robert, was born in 1863 but died a year later. The cause of death was the decidedly vague but ever-present gastric fever. That child was hardly in his grave when Marianne's 39-year-old husband William returned home. He had suffered a foot injury while at sea. It was assumed he would heal faster when he was properly taken care of by his wife. Sadly, though, he soon succumbed, per his death certificate, to intestinal disorders. His doctor made a note that it was surprising how fast he had gone downhill. Aside from his foot, he had seemed so healthy. Marianne buried him in January 1865, then collected about £35 from his insurer. That would hold her for about 6 months. She needed to find another husband, and fast.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Marianne moved around a lot, though never outside the north of England. It's hard to say if that's because she couldn't bear to stay where she would always be reminded of her husband and lost children, or if she wanted to make it that much harder for authorities to keep track of her sometimes growing, sometimes shrinking family. In 1865, she landed in Seaham Harbor, County Durham, and began an affair with Joseph Natress. She seemed genuinely in love with him. He was, alas, already engaged to another woman. She tried to break them up, but was unsuccessful. He was a crappy fiancé, but apparently not so crappy that he was willing to dump his betrothed for Marianne. Too soon, tragedy would strike again. Marianne's older child, the second Margaret Jane, died of typhus. No, really, it was typhus, which is not a pretty death.
Typhus, not to be confused with typhoid, is an infectious bacterial disease spread by body lice. It begins with flu-like symptoms and a characteristic rash. And untreated, it can progress to inflammation of the brain, meningoencephalitis, confusion, delirium, and death. It was common in the 19th century and was responsible for tens of thousands of deaths in the Great Irish Famine. The signs of the disease would have been very familiar to doctors at the time. So little Margaret was probably not one of her mother's victims.
Marianne moved on, this time to Sunderland, and got a job being a nurse at the Sunderland Institute and House of Recovery for the Cure of Contagious Fever. Author Shelley Klein, who profiled Marianne in her book, The Most Evil Women in History, wrote that records show that Marianne was a hard worker and was noted for her, quote, concern for the welfare of her patients, end quote. It was at the hospital that she found George Ward, who was convalescing there. He was a good marriage prospect. She swooped in. It's around this time that she decided to send surviving daughter Isabella to live with her mother. You'll remember the mother is named Margaret. 7 months after she saw William Mowbray go to his eternal rest, she married Ward, who was soon convinced to bequeath all his worldly goods to his new wife in the event of his death. A little more than a year later, Ward died, poor man, of what doctors would characterize as English cholera, a fancy name for prolonged intestinal distress and typhoid. His wife grieved by taking a nice holiday. Records are a bit confusing here, but it looks like she was still in Sunderland when she met James Robinson, a just-widowed father of five, when she applied for a housekeeper job at his home. A month into her new employ, one of Robinson's children, a 10-month-old baby named James, died of gastric fever. Robinson, a shipbuilder, turned to the housekeeper for comfort, and it turned out Marianne was very good at comforting. She became pregnant. They set a wedding date, but that had to be postponed when, in March 1867, Marianne was called home to nurse her mother, who had contracted hepatitis. The good news was that when Marianne arrived, her mother was improving daily. Marianne stayed on. Within 9 days, days in which her mother relapsed, it seemed, Margaret Robson died after suffering severe stomach cramps, vomiting, and diarrhea. This meant Marianne had to take 7-year-old Isabella back with her to James Robinson's home. Robinson had little chance to get to know little Isabella because she soon became ill with gastric fever and died. Then, two of Robinson's children followed her in death. Wouldn't you know it, it was that dreaded gastric fever again. The Robinson children were buried within a week of one another. The insurance payout for Isabella was a little more than £5, which must have made a tidy wedding gift to the unlucky couple who married in August 1867. Their first child was born in November. She died 4 months later. The cause of death was reported to be convulsion and stomach inflammation. Marianne then had a son, born in the summer of 1869. James Robinson was finally concerned for himself and for his newborn child. His 5 children, who had all been healthy before he had met Marianne, were now dead. Her own child had died. Her mother had died. Was he the only one noticing? And there was this other matter. His wife seemed to always be in need of money, though he was a good provider. She was also now pushing him to get some insurance on his own life should the worst befall him. Robinson had not confided in others about his now pretty serious suspicions. Before he made anything public, though, he looked into his own household finances, including the account that he'd given over to Marianne to manage. Sure enough, she had been running up debt, even sending their children, while they were living, to pawnbrokers to sell whatever valuables he and his former wife had shared. He was done. He didn't contact authorities. He simply told her to get out and to leave the baby with him. She had no choice but to go. Where she was for the next few months is a mystery to those who have tracked her progress through husbands and children. She turned up again when she got a job as a matron at the Sunderland Penitentiary. She also found herself a young naval officer, but didn't push for marriage. Instead, she stole everything from him while he was at sea. She relocated again, this time finding work in a doctor's office. In need of money, she had stolen cash and objects from the doctor's home. He found out and sacked her. She kept moving. She found herself now in Walbital in Northumberland. There, she reacquainted herself with an old friend, Margaret Cotton, who was living with her brother, Frederick. Margaret was busy helping her brother out. He was recently widowed and had also lost two of his four children. He wanted someone to care and cook for him and his two young boys. Margaret introduced Frederick to Mary Ann. What do you suppose happened next? You can say it with me. Soon, Margaret died. Care to guess of what? That's right, gastric fever. Another man needing consolation ended up in Mary Ann's bed. And then, you know what's coming next, she became pregnant. Frederick Cotton, being an upright kind of fellow, proposed marriage. They tied the knot in September 1870 in Newcastle upon Tyne, in the same church where she had said I do the first time to William Mowbray. Those of you paying very close attention will note that Mary Ann is now guilty of at least a few murders, as well as bigamy, because James Robinson had simply told her to scram. He hadn't bothered to get a divorce from her. I have no idea how Mary Ann managed to manipulate this succession of men. She must have been quite persuasive, because she now was able to convince Frederick Cotton to take out life insurance on his two children, as well as on himself. That done, she gave birth to a son in early 1871. Frederick Cotton would be dead within a few months, but not before the family had to move to West Auckland in County Durham. That move was precipitated by the need to get away from some angry neighbors who, after a dispute with Mary Ann, found that several of their pigs fell ill and died. West Auckland was also where Joseph Natras, her lifelong crush, had moved after he had become available again after the death of his wife. And aside here, no one suspects Mary Ann of making Mrs. Natras shake loose her mortal coil, but I wouldn't take any bets. Mary Ann most certainly had something to do with Frederick's death, though, as he was felled by the terribly familiar onslaught of cramping, vomiting, and diarrhea. Two of Frederick's sons, one from his previous wife and baby Robert, were not far behind him. They, too, couldn't shake the stomach troubles that came on so quickly and struck them down. Mary Ann Cotton was stoic, as usual. Her new neighbors would later remark that she was oddly composed in the face of all that tragedy, but they knew that women in that day and age in Britain were not expected to be overly showy in their grief. They were expected to be strong and to bear it gracefully. Still, the neighbors weren't blind. The town noticed what happened next. Joseph Natras moved into the Cotton home as a boarder. Mary Ann, ever convinced of the need to keep up with one's afterlife directions, persuaded Natras to rewrite his will so that she might benefit from anything bad that might happen to him. That, of course, meant she had no more use of Natras, who was not long for this life. For all of you doing the math, that's four more dead in her wake, plus some pigs. More life insurance collected, £30 for Natras alone, and it was time to keep moving. She began a job nursing a man named James Quick Manning, who was recovering from smallpox. See, her goal in life, a la Scarlett O'Hara, was to never go hungry again, and her method of achieving it was working. It was messy, but efficient. And, she was sure, damn near undetectable.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
everyone. Before we get back to the show, just a reminder that you can get bonus episodes and bonus material at grabbagcollab.com. Just go to grabbagcollab.com and choose which tier you'd like to subscribe to. Thanks so much. Let's talk about arsenic. Or better yet, let's have scientist Neil Bradbury talk about it in a TED-Ed.
It's a naturally occurring, widely distributed metallic element. In its chemically pure form, it isn't much of a threat because our bodies don't absorb it well. It's when arsenic combines with other elements that things get dangerous. When arsenic reacts with oxygen, it may assume its most common poisonous form, white arsenic, a powder that can be immediately lethal or kill over time.
It exists in soil, water, and air, and in both organic and inorganic forms. It's been known about since the 4th century. Not long after, its notoriety as a poisoning agent became widespread. It was a fave in the Middle Ages and through the Renaissance as the Borgia Medicis fought it out in Italy. If you've listened to this podcast much, I'm sure you've caught on that arsenic poisoning is a highly effective means of killing someone, especially if you'd like them to suffer. That's because it just wreaks havoc on the human body in a thousand ways. It attacks cellular metabolism. It discolors the skin and causes fatigue. It taxes the heart and produces irregular rhythms and failure. It damages the lungs and entire respiratory systems. It causes mental confusion and often prompts seizures. The liver and kidneys simply can't keep up in their stated mission of getting rid of the body's toxins. This makes the ingester susceptible to all kinds of infection and, ultimately, to multiple organ failure. Did I mention that the poisoning's effects also tend to mimic the symptoms experienced by those with other disease, which has made it, in the past, hard to detect? Cholera, for example, which took hold in the UK in 1831, killed 52,000 and looked a lot like gastric fever and the result of arsenic poisoning. But it's only fair to note that arsenic was also being put to use in a variety of more wholesome enterprises. As Dr. Yorston says,
although its toxicity had long been recognized, it was used as a beauty product and in dozens of medicinal compounds purporting to treat everything from epilepsy, hysteria, melancholia, dropsy, rickets, malaria, ulcers, syphilis, cancer, and worms. Oh yes, and all kinds of stomach ailments.
It, of course, can be found in seafood, mushrooms, rice, and poultry. It's also been used as an insecticide and a handy way to kill vermin like rats. It could be found in dyes and cleaning products. It was used to make beer and wine, painted on toys, found in coal and candles, and it was added to wallpaper during Victorian times to make the colors brighter, especially in a color called Parisian green. Trouble was, when the bright wallpaper became damp, arsenic fumes would be released and, if you were close, inhaled. In a long-standing historical debate, many believe that Napoleon Bonaparte was deliberately murdered with poison, as his preserved hair samples have shown a high concentration of it over time. Others say that the amount of arsenic in his body was more likely the result of him sleeping in a room that was wallpapered with Parisian green. More recently, researchers have concluded that Napoleon had just about the same amount of arsenic in him that other contemporaries had at the time, and that he had died of stomach cancer. I digress there, but not too much. You might ask what makes arsenic such a handy homicidal helper. It's odorless, tasteless, and dissolves easily in food or drink. It's also cheap, and in the 1800s at least, was available at your local green grocer. It has the happy distinction of being referred to as the king of poisons because of its potency and discreetness, and it's also, conversely, the poison of kings because of its frequent use in killing them off. For a time there, people knew it as inheritance powder. I don't think I need to explain that one. That was a neat trick because up until 1836, there was no reliable way for medical personnel to detect its presence in the human body. Prosecutors, thus, had no way to use it in court to prove cause of death. But authorities were trying. In 1832, they asked chemist James Marsh to try to find some way to detect the element in the body of George Bodle, a murder victim. George's grandson, John, was on trial in the case. According to an explainer written by Case Western Reserve in 2017, Marsh found, quote, that adding bodily tissues to a glass vessel with zinc would produce a gas. If heated and ignited, it would turn to arsenic and water vapor, which would be seen as a metallic film on a ceramic vessel, end quote. That turned out to be an imperfect test. The film would evaporate before it was time to show it in court, but chemists and the scientific method fixed that by 1836. An improved test was developed in 1841 by Hugo Reinsch. By the time Marianne was a proficient user of the product, testing was understood by most and familiar in courtrooms. So effective were the means of detection that, by the end of the 19th century, arsenic lost its appeal for those intent on committing murder and not getting caught. Marianne had either missed the memo or figured she changed jurisdiction so often that she would continue eluding suspicion. But Marianne was about to get sloppy. Remember that she had dispensed with all but one of the cottons, had bid adieu to Joseph Natress, and moved on to nursing Quick Manning? Marianne, as was her wont, soon became pregnant by him. For reasons no one can explain, she was still toting around Charles, one of Cotton's children. Her routine was settling in when a public servant, a parish official named Thomas Riley, hearing that Marianne had some nursing experience, asked her if she would take on the care of a woman with smallpox. Marianne declined the offer of work, but taking advantage of the opportunity, asked Riley how she might get her 7-year-old stepson into a workhouse. Riley knew that workhouses were the last resort for the poor who could not feed their children. These institutions were created to make public assistance the most unenviable of choices. Children just out of diapers were forced to work long hours and live in deplorable conditions without care. This was before Britain instituted social services and national health care available to all. In an episode of Absolute History, narrator Robert Clotworthy explained,
"Astonishingly, the workhouse survived well into the modern era, until after the Second World War. In 100 years, it was home to over 16 million people caught between poverty and destitution."
Of the 16 million, 5 million died there. For any mother in her circumstances, which were by no means dire, to offer up her child to this destiny was shocking. Yorston again.
And not surprisingly, the parish officer was taken aback. And when he had demurred, Marianne shrugged her shoulders and uttered the chilling words that would be her undoing. "I won't be troubled long. He'll go like all the rest of the cottons."
Marianne perhaps didn't realize Thomas Riley was also the assistant coroner for West Auckland. After Riley's inability to help her unload the little boy, she wasted no time in sending the child to the chemist's shop. In his hand, he held instructions to buy some arsenic. The chemist informed the child that buyers had to be 21 years old. Charles went back and told his stepmother what the chemist said, so Marianne had her neighbor pick up the powder. The chemists were required to keep records, you know, on a poison register. She may have wanted to be careful. Charles died 5 days after Marianne had tried to get Riley to warehouse him. His death had all the markings of gastric fever. The news of his death reached Riley, who went to the police and asked them to hold on to the little boy's body. He also asked the boy's doctor to stall on delivering the death certificate until they knew more. By now, Marianne had discovered that she would get no money for the child's death, even though her premiums were up to date. The insurers told her that she had to have a death certificate before they would issue her the £5 she was sure she was due. Because the coroner asked for an inquest into the death, the press was alerted to the irregularity. The inquest took place in a bar next to Marianne's boarding house on West Auckland's Front Street. She maintained that she had nursed the child as best as she knew how, and that, well, she had rebuffed Riley's sexual advances, and he was doing all of this to get back at her. Jurors listened, but their findings were disappointing. The child's autopsy had proven nonspecific. The testing for the presence of arsenic had been done on the stomach tissue, not the best option for doing it, and the verdict was that he had died from natural causes. Charles Cotton was buried, but the press had heard Riley recount the child's pregnant stepmother's oh-so-recent inquiry about putting him to work and, failing that, having him go the way of his siblings and father. What had happened to the rest of the Cottons? The digging began in earnest now, with reporters from other jurisdictions in northern England weighing in on what they found when they asked around. Marianne's offhand remark to a minor government employee toppled her house of cards. She looked to all the world to be the killer of three husbands, her mother, her friend, a lover, and at least 11 children. All had died from acute intestinal assault. The West Auckland doctor had not given up in the interim. He had taken samples from the boy's hair, nails, and blood. When the results came back, they showed that Charles' tissues contained uncommon levels of arsenic. It was enough to get her arrested. And Charles' body was removed from the ground for further analysis. Marianne was arraigned for the single murder on May 6, 1873. The public could hardly believe what they were reading in the newspapers. The sensitive people out there couldn't comprehend a child murderer. The less-than-sensitive invoked Marianne's name as a threat, telling disobedient children that if they didn't behave, Marianne Cotton would get them next.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
In 19th century Britain, women accused of crimes while pregnant could ask for their trials to be postponed until after they delivered. It was so common, it was called pleading the belly. It doesn't quite have the same force as pleading the fifth, but it worked. At least for Marianne, who named Quick Manning as the father when she bore another child, a girl named, say it with me now, Margaret. Quick Manning took no responsibility for the infant, who was immediately removed from Marianne's care and put up for adoption. Marianne had a chance of getting away with it. Her lawyers explained to the jury that she used arsenic in her cleaning rituals, and perhaps some of the residue from that solution on the floors had made its way into Charles's mouth. They told him how his bed was situated in a room that had been wallpapered with a pattern of bright colors, and that the defendant couldn't always keep things dry. So, sadly, toxic arsenic fumes were likely inhaled by him on a regular basis. They brought up Napoleon. Marianne could explain it all, but the prosecutors were one step ahead of her. Before the trial began in March of 1873, they appealed to the judge in the case, a Mr. Justice Archibald. This is from Shelley Klein's chapter on Marianne. Prosecutors argued, quote, that in order to prove her systemic approach to the murder of Charles Cotton, evidence should be heard in respect to the deaths of Joseph Natras as well as several other victims, end quote. Mr. Justice Archibald agreed that the other deaths could be referenced, thus allowing a whole slew of witnesses to her actions in years past to testify. Doctors who had been surprised by their patient's sudden demises told the jury about the deaths where she had been in attendance. The chemists who kept records outlined when she had bought arsenic and in what amount. Pattern and motive were foregone conclusions now. The press was in the courtroom every day, writing how cold and somber she was, how few tears she shed. The jury deliberated for 90 minutes. Finding her guilty as charged, she was sentenced to be hanged. She cried then. And yet, she somehow expected that Queen Victoria would pardon her. She was mother, after all. She'd lost a husband. No pardon came. On March 24th, 1873, 41-year-old Marianne was led from her jail cell to face the country's most infamous executioner, a man named William Calcraft. During the span of his 45-year career, he personally hanged 450 convicts. Some believed he enjoyed it. He was known for jumping into the pit with the condemned to use his own body weight to hasten a lingering death.
After 3 minutes, the thrashing and convulsions of the convicted poisoner finally slowed down until only a faint twitching indicated that her body had once been alive.
She died of asphyxiation rather than a broken neck. Some observers note she was, quote, strangled like a rabid dog with no dignity, even in death, end quote. No one was left to mourn her. She had maintained her innocence to the end. Well, I think. That's what most media reported, but I did find a brief in the Manchester Evening News published March 24th, 1873 that claimed, quote, before her death, she confessed to having poisoned her stepson, and when questioned as to the others who died under mysterious circumstances, she remained silent, end quote. The closest I found to that reported elsewhere was worded differently, that she acknowledged she might have unintentionally administered poison to her stepson. So yeah, I think she tried to claim it was an accident at the very end, but she didn't really confess. One element of the Manchester story that I did find reported in a few spots, however, was that her death was so violent and unsettling that the undersheriff actually fainted. Marianne would be remembered in the homes of small children because the British have this quaint habit of immortalizing much of their past in nursery rhymes that, while sounding innocent, might hide terrible things. Think Ring Around the Rosie, Three Blind Mice, London Bridge. Here are those folks from I Could Murder singing the rhyme referencing Marianne Cotton. I would do it for you myself, but no one would appreciate that. Plus, they really nailed the tone.
Marianne Cotton, she's dead and forgotten, lying in beds with her bones all rotten. Sing, sing, what can I sing? Marianne Cotton tied up with string. Where, she's up in the air, selling her black puddings a penny a pair.
Black pudding, for the British food challenged, is made of pig's blood. Which brings me back to the dead milkman, I guess, who may or may not have inspired Ian Smith Herdman to create the website mariannecotton.com.uk. In it, Smith Herdman lays out evidence that Marianne was railroaded in a way that wouldn't be allowed today. That is, he believed that the case would be, in his words, quote, dismissed on the grounds of lack of factual evidence or be overturned on retrial on points of law, end quote. Smith Herdman maintains that Charles Cotton's arsenic levels were high because of organic arsenic in the soil where he lay before he was disinterred. He points to Charles' chronic diarrhea as being a symptom of tuberculosis, something for which he was being treated at the time of his death. He points out that the home in which the child died had many empty bottles of medication that were sent off for analysis, but for which no findings were placed in evidence. That's just the tip of the iceberg. He told the Northern Echo newspaper, which serves the region where the murders occurred, that he believes Marianne was a very good fever nurse and that, yes, she may have been a troubled person, but she wasn't a psychopath. In multiple interviews, Smith Herdman promised a book that would present Marianne's side of things. That was in 2016. I couldn't find that he had written or published such a book. A previously published book, written by Arthur Appleton in 1973, maintains that there is not enough evidence to convict Marianne of all the murders. Fair point. Still, Smith Herdman seems to want a full exoneration. He told the Daily Mail in 2016 that, quote, it's sickening that over the years, Marianne Cotton's family has had to suffer hearsay, rumors, and accounts of Marianne Cotton being accurate, when I'd say 99% of the information is nothing more than rehashed accounts, end quote. Only one brother survived her. That was the youngest, Michael. Her older brother died at age 25 in 1860, 13 years before Marianne's execution. I couldn't find his cause of death. Beyond that, Marianne left behind just two children. One was the Robinson child. I have no idea what happened to him. We know more about the other. On April 2, 2018, Northern Echo reporters went looking for the final daughter who survived, the one Margaret had nursed in her jail cell. Reporters found that Margaret had married a minor at 17, had two children, but found it hard to escape her mother's notoriety. In 1893, the family sailed for New York, finding work first in Pennsylvania. Then, when a third child was born, the family could be found in California. Margaret's husband died in a railway accident there, and a pregnant Margaret brought her family back home to Durham. She remarried, again to a minor. Her two sons went off to fight in World War I and never came home. She died sometime in the 1950s, remembered, wrote the paper, quote, as immensely private, intelligent, warm, and kind-hearted, and a devoted wife, mother, and grandmother, end quote. I have to think she must have taken after her father. To research and write this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Shelley Klein's The Most Evil Women in History, watched more than a handful of documentaries about her, and learned more than she wanted to know about arsenic and creepy nursery rhymes. I, meanwhile, referenced genealogical records and contemporary news reports. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.